Really a warm welcome to you in these extraordinary times to be here. And we're starting the first of the Beginners Foundation course. So I have a screen share that I'm going to have up for the class. So yeah, this is it's a 10-week course, and I've put it together because I've got a lot of friends that say, oh, yeah, if I was going to be anything, I'd be a Buddhist, but they're not necessarily a Buddhist or don't necessarily feel religious as such. So how to actually find out about, you know, what Buddhism is all about and how it's relevant for our day-to-day life. Also, if you kind of got an interest in Buddhism and wondering where on earth do I start? Like, it's quite a huge topic, and where's a place to start that's going to be relevant, that's not just a theoretical thing, or, you know, if you pick up a book by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, depending which one it is, if it's like The Art of Happiness, it's going to be really accessible. And if it's about epistemology and ontological blah, 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 you might just think, whoa, I'll just put that aside for a few years. So where to actually get started so that we kind of are able to naturally develop. So for the online people, I was going to say, if you can stay on after the class for a little while, then you can ask your questions, you know, to me, because I can't kind of split the online and the in-person at the same time. So I'm going to start with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, actually. And someone asked about, asked His Holiness, what's the meaning of life? They were at, I think, a diner or a restaurant somewhere, and it was the waitress that came up and said, and by the way, Holiness, what's the meaning of life? And all the rest of the entourage there were like, oh, how's he going to answer this one? So how would you answer it? Have you had that question come up in your mind? What's the meaning of life? What's it all about? And did any answers pop up, or are you still searching, or anything at all that's become apparent that's like super important or that brings meaning to your life? Still wondering? Perhaps that's why you're here.
Family,
yeah. Yes, it brings a lot of meaning and heartfelt feeling. What His Holiness said, these three things: life is about becoming happier, about finding meaning, just like you said, and about helping others. And so the one-line answer that he gave to the wonderful waitress who asked the question was, oh, look, the purpose of life is to be happy and to be useful, which is so wonderful, isn't it? So we all really want to be happier. We want to end our life happier than how we began our life, but it doesn't necessarily turn out that way. And certainly there's no, we don't have to feel guilty or bad like about wanting to be happy. That is it's a natural instinctual urge. Not just humans, but everybody. If you've got pets, you know your pets want to be happy as well. It's not something that we have to think about. And yet it's so elusive. But we want a lot more than just the kind of the happiness. We need to have some meaning, because we can have a really good time. I know I had a really good time for a while in my 20s, lots of partying and lots of vodka. But there was this thought, like, what's it for? What's the point? Because, you know, I just spent however many years, almost a decade, having a party. I can't even remember it. What was the point? What's it for? So we also have this urge for meaning that we don't have to think about. It's this real longing. So to be happy and to be useful. So from a Buddhist point of view, actually the way that we find the most happiness is by helping others, even in a really very, you know, apparently small way. By helping others or contributing, then we get also a sense of worth, that we're worth something, that our life has some meaning. So if we care for others, then even if we're feeling pretty miserable, we're going to have a good feeling come from that as well. We can really, it's a much deeper thing than how our moods are or our even our state of mind. So His Holiness also said this other quote, world peace through inner peace and inner peace through helping others. So we want to live in a nice, safe world, a conducive world, a friendly world, a healthy world. And yet the way that we go about it often is trying to force everybody and everybody else to change and still kind of agitated in our own mind. But if we want a peaceful world, we have to start with ourselves, because even if we had a peaceful world, if our own mind isn't peaceful, we're not going to experience a peaceful world. So it's got to start within and then kind of radiate out outwards. And the most amazing way to actually find some inner peace is by helping others. So that's what this course is going to be about. Hi, come in, come in. We're going to have a look at the main Buddhist principles, whether you're Buddhist or not, whether you're religious or not. They're universal kind of understandings. There's also no kind of pressure to convert to become a Buddhist, but also what His Holiness said, you know, that you just take what's useful for you and put the rest aside, and certainly take your time. And not just kind of what intellectual, but what's useful to our life. The other way that this course can be beneficial is that I've kind of structured it around the main Buddhist principles, but I've added in some extra things, like a whole class on rebirth and reincarnation, because, you know, in the land of India and Nepal and the Buddha's time, that was just a given culturally. It didn't have to be kind of talked about. Whereas for us, it's not a cultural given. So we have to actually talk about it, even though it's not so specifically put as a topic in the texts. So we'll have a look at some extra things like that. All the nice juicy topics like compassion, equanimity, and karma, and how to set up a meditation practice. So with the introductions, it's a bit tricky that we've all got masks on, but turn to each other and let's just take just a couple of minutes just to say your name and maybe one reason why you came here today. So there were quite a few things online too about just wanting, continuing on from the last week's course, last month's course, and then also having a foundation for Buddhist study. So I think this course will be able to give you the kind of the architecture or the structure to hang everything else on, which means that it's way less stressful to try and figure out where you are in your reading or your studies, where does it all fit together, the big picture. So today's class, we're going to look at what's the essence of the Buddha's teachings and what it is, you know, what is a Buddhist actually, what makes somebody a Buddhist, and what we can take from it. Within that, we're going to have a look at what are called the three jewels of refuge, or the three rare sublime ones, and generally what refuge is, because often when you enter a new religion or find out about a new religion, there's usually a ceremony of some sort where you convert or you become a Buddhist or you become a this or become a that. So what's the kind of the Buddhist equivalent? So it's certainly not about turning into something else, but there is this you know, natural urge that we have for refuge. So what that is from a Buddhist point of view and what the refuge is, and also what our kind of default refuge is at the moment. And then how big can our goal be? How far can we go with this? Do we dare to dream? Have we put limitations on ourselves of what we can accomplish as a human being, as a living being? So it's really nice to think about that. Let's do a short motivation just to settle our mind and already bring some purpose to tonight. So first we'll adjust our body and then adjust our attitude, our mind. So physically, whether you're sitting cross-legged or on a chair or in bed or whatever it is, try and have your posture so that you feel relatively alert. So a nice straight spine. fairly symmetrical if you can. Feel nicely grounded sitting on your seat. To straighten your spine, imagine that there is a fine thread of light running up the inside of your body from the base of your spine up through your body and coming out the crown of your head. And feel as if you're suspended by this thread of light. So you might naturally notice how your posture realigns a little. And then once your back is relatively straight, then let your shoulders relax and let go of the tension held in the neck and the shoulders. Become present in the room. And just like there might be sounds and activity going on around you, but you're nice and calm sitting here. So same with our mind. There might be activity going on in the mind, thoughts, feelings, distractions. Just leave that in the periphery. And just gently rest your focus on breathing in and breathing out, the coming and going of the breath, the sensation of the air at the tip of the nostrils, where the air enters and leaves the body. Just this one place. And anchor your attention there. Let everything else settle down, just like autumn leaves come to rest once the wind has stopped. And feel how wonderful that we've managed to find the time and the opportunity tonight to be here. And gently bring to mind what your purpose is. Also, if you manage to speak to any of your other classmates, the details might be different, but fundamentally we're here for the same reason. We want to be happy, we want to have a meaningful life. We have questions. So taking this as our basis, then we can broaden our motivation to make sure it's altruistic. Why put a limit on it? But think that by us doing this course together, may it bring the most benefit, may it benefit the most living beings, the most people. May it be the seeds for accomplishing all of our hopes and dreams and wishes, for making our life meaningful, for bringing happiness to ourselves and everyone we encounter. And may it not just be for those that we know, our close circle, but may that benefit that we derive, may it continue and affect every single living being on the planet. May we be able to bring an ultimate benefit to everybody by starting right here with ourselves. So with this motivation, nice deep breath in through the nose. Let it out gently. So I forgot to introduce myself. I'm not even wearing a name badge. But by the way, my name's Miffy. And I'm the spiritual program coordinator here, and also put this course together many, many years ago, and it continues to kind of change and develop. I was actually brought up a Buddhist, but it certainly doesn't mean that I'm a good Buddhist, okay? So brought up a Buddhist in Australia with kind of bohemian parents who became really interested in yoga and then Theravada Buddhism and then Tibetan Buddhism. And my mother met Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa Rinpoche, who's here on the throne. So I kind of grew up with the Tibetan lamas, feeling really close to them instead of really shy as an adult, and with all of the ceremonies. And then as I kind of, you know, went through my teenage years and my 20s, was a bit of a rebel and really didn't want to just take on all of my parents' beliefs and attitudes just because that's what I inherited. I really wanted to carve my own way. So in my mind, I just threw everything out, and what was left was pretty much the goodness of the lamas, that these teachers were really genuine and really practiced what they preached, and what they talked about made some sense. So I had that as my starting point, and then had many spirited debates all the way through about all sorts of things to do with Buddhist philosophy and practice, and was really encouraged to do so. So, you know, and then of course I kind of lived my life and left home and started making costumes for circuses and self-medicating with way too much vodka and being a bit of a rabble rouser. And, you know, I thought I was a good Buddhist, but no way. I probably had Buddhist tendencies, but that's as far as it went. So, you know, as we go through the course, it'll be peppered with my own kind of experience and also the struggles that I've had just with trying to bridge such a deep philosophy and worldview with our very distractible life. And how do we do it? So let's have a look. What is a Buddhist? So there's this wonderful verse: avoid harm, practice virtue, subdue your mind. This is the essence of the teachings of the Buddha. So actually what a Buddhist is isn't someone that's turned into something else, that's turned into a Buddhist. But if we do this, then we're a Buddhist. And, you know, in the time of the Buddha, there wasn't a such thing as a Buddhist. In fact, what a Buddhist was an inner being, or someone who looked within their own mind, looked within our own experience, rather than looking outside of us to events or entertainment or other people for our solutions, to look within. And as His Holiness often says, you know, it's we ourselves who experience problems. So that's where we've got to start, as we ourselves, not with the things out there. So what's quite amazing about this verse is the order. I mean, this is what struck me. First off, avoid harm, and then if you can, practice virtue. So the avoiding harm, to cease harming ourselves and others, or to cease putting in place all the causes for suffering, all the causes for problems, which we unwittingly do all the time. You know, I just look at my misspent youth and then the effects of a misspent youth. I didn't plan to have a bit of a rocky road in life, but that was just the result of it. So to be able to actually avoid harm and causing, putting in place all the causes for problems and sufferings that might come up later on. Even just, you know, drinking way too much. If I had have kept on drinking, then I would have died, like my ex-husband died of liver cancer, because he didn't stop drinking and he certainly didn't plan to become ill, but just the results caught up with him. So that's the first thing. The first thing that we got to do is to cease harm. And if that's all we do in our life, that's fantastic. We become a safe person to be with, and we stop making things worse. So even though it's not big and dramatic, it's really important. It's like, you know, half of the equation right there. And then to practice virtue, so to put in place all of the causes for happiness. We want to be happy, we've got to put in place the causes for it. So virtue is, you know, whatever creates happiness, causes happiness. And how to do this? By subduing our mind, by looking within. By looking within first. Because if we can't subdue our mind, then even if we live in a beautiful, peaceful, wonderful environment, we're going to be dissatisfied. So it's really cutting to the chase to tame our mind and to get some control over our mind. So that's the essence of the Buddha's teachings. The Buddha's teachings isn't about a religion or a dogma or a philosophy or a turning into something else, but it's actually kind of very effective psychological cause and effect. So it means you don't have to become a Buddhist to benefit from the Buddhist teachings. And as we take on board some of this stuff, then we'll naturally develop a sense of confidence, but it's based on reasoning and our experience and research rather than just belief. So, you know, we can avoid blind faith, which can let us down. We can avoid hopeful belief. You know, lots of people have this hopeful belief that she'll be right, you know, with COVID. Really, a very strongly held hopeful belief isn't going to protect us, is it? So, but it's very easy to fall into. Anyone who's ever gambled at the races has a hopeful belief at the beginning. So we want to avoid all of those things. So finding a refuge. So how do we avoid all of those things? How do we cease harming ourselves and others? How do we actually put in place the causes for happiness? Is to do with finding a refuge. And a refuge, it's like looking for protection or guidance. Like in a storm, you know, you find refuge from the storm, from the rain. And we all seek a refuge, whether we do it consciously or not. So apparently, like in the heat of battle, you know, when soldiers die, they either say, "Mum," they call out for mum, or they call out for God. You know, they're like our default kind of refuge. It's not something that you're thinking about, it just comes out. We have this yearning or this wish for a refuge, a need for safety and shelter. So Buddhist refuge, though, actually is a lot more than that, because it implies taking responsibility for our own experience rather than wanting someone else to fix it. It's kind of a big deal because we're taking the responsibility now. We're going to do something about it, almost like taking responsibility for our own health, which I think now I'm really bad at. So the causes for taking refuge and the Dharma or the teachings of the Buddha is often referred to as like the protection, like an umbrella. You know, there's the rainfall of misfortune that falls down all the in our life. And we can protect ourselves. All we need is this umbrella. We don't have to stop the rain. We can just protect our mind, protect our heart, our peace. So there are various kind of motivating forces for this, and often it might be fear, that we've got a dread of continuing in the way that we're going now, that it's just how our life is going at the moment is no good. You know, we're thinking, gee whiz, the clock is ticking. It can't be, this can't be it. or we have, we're in fearful situations, and we don't like that fear. We don't like experiencing that kind of dread. What if I die now? Or what if I die from COVID? Or, you know, what if things go wrong? But it doesn't always have to be fear that motivates us. It can also be inspiration, that we have a confidence that what we're taking refuge in can actually help us. So we have a really warm feeling. So when we, you know, often when people think of their mum, you know, there's an inspiration or a feeling of confidence there. Not everybody, but, you know, most people. So this is what we really have to investigate, what our inspiration is, and so that we have energy to continue the path. Because if we're just on a spiritual path through fear alone, that's not enough to sustain us. We're just going to get miserable and guilty, and, you know, we actually need to be inspired and know this is possible. It's possible to change. So that's the other one. And of course, the third, which is kind of like the uncommon reason for taking refuge, is the wish to help others. So if there's someone close to you that you wish you can help and you don't know how to. So it might be a family member, or you might work with, you know, rescue animals, or it might be with trying to save, you know, the climate. So for oneself, you know, whatever happens, you're okay. But for others, no, you can't let it stand. You know, a lot of people with social justice, they go out and do a whole lot of work for others that they normally wouldn't do, public speaking or anything, but because it's for others, it's a huge motivator. So the wish to help others, compassion. So what we want to do is first off ask, what are we seeking refuge in at the moment? What's our default go-to refuge when we're feeling bad? So what do we normally do, folks? Apart from have a nap and eat too many Tim Tams. What do we do? What's our refuge?
Watch Netflix.
That's a really big one, isn't it? Yes. What else? Yeah. Dance. Fantastic. Who else? Yes. Go to the gym. Equally fantastic. Glass of wine, yes. Yep. What else? What other refuges? Yeah.
Go for a ride on a motorcycle.
Ride on a motorcycle, yep. So all of these things, I mean, and in particular like motorcycles or a glass of wine, they're within the context, they're kind of nice, but they're not sustainable, are they? And there can be side effects that are not so good. Or, you know, if we're not allowed to go to the gym or we can't go out dancing, you know, when there's a lockdown, then what do? So a lot of our refuges, what our refuge is at the moment, is very circumstantial and it's out of our control. And that's a precarious way to live, isn't it? Because what if those things are taken away from us? Then what do? So, of course, we start living in a constant state of anxiety because of that. So what about inner refuges?
Meditation?
That can, it can also make us more anxious if we don't know how to do it. But yeah, that inner reflection. Journaling, sometimes I found journaling really helpful, just being able to put things in words and get a little bit of distance from them. You said family, you know, so looking after the family or having a sense of responsibility from the family can be a real refuge. And that's, I mean, especially when the lockdown happened early on with COVID, that was a main refuge that people took. Great, we'll spend more time now with the family. What else? Yeah.
Rereading Buddhism for Dummies.
Aha, rereading and rereading Buddhism for Dummies, or rereading Dostoevsky or whatever, you know. But yes, reading is a big one. Yep. Yes. So you get the idea. We've got a whole lot of default things. I mean, also we might have default things like just, you know, go out and gamble, or just get on Facebook and 10 hours later, you know, there's many. So how do we know that we found a valid refuge, or a refuge that will help us, a refuge that will help us solve problems? We've got to check up. So we have to use reasoning and see, does it stand up to investigation? Does it make sense? Then check, not only does it make sense, but check when you apply it in your own life, does it accord with your own experience? So if we take that approach, then what we can end up with is a sense of confidence instead of just a sense of blind faith or just a sense of hope, hopefulness, to have a natural confidence. And it means that, say, for instance, you won't lose your faith, because if your faith is based on reasoning and based on research and then checking with your own experience, and you apply something, you do some meditation and you notice you become more peaceful, you know, someone can say, oh, meditation's a crock. You're going to go, oh, that's okay, whatever. But it's not going to rock your foundations. So before we go on, any other questions, comments? All you have to do is just wave your arm around because, you know, it's a bit tricky to tell. So we can do a little reflection. What do we seek refuge from? Refuge from what? So let's just, however we do a reflection, if you're feeling a bit tired, then keep your eyes open, but just pick a kind of neutral spot in the space in front. And bring your mind to a couple of situations that you might seek refuge from. It could be actually the reasons that brought you here tonight. So we have various details, the circumstances of what goes wrong in our life. But there are some universal experiences that we all have, the highs and lows of our life constantly going up and down. We're very rarely stable or content. We just get one thing sorted and then the next thing comes along. So even though when it happens to us, we feel like we're the only one in the whole world that it's happened to. This is a universal experience, the highs and lows of our life. We also suffer from uncertainty. We often suffer from loneliness, even though we might be surrounded by many people. Inside, we can feel lonely. And when we go through difficult experiences, no one can go through those experiences for us. And yet, this is what we have in common with everybody, this common loneliness. We all have a sense of dissatisfaction. We all have to deal with the complexities of having a body, a physical form, learning how to do all the stuff, life maintenance, look after yourself, be healthy, master all those new skills and new technology. So these are the universal problems that human beings experience. So how do we normally try and escape from them? How we normally would escape might change over time, or we may be thwarted. We may not be able to go on that hike or that ride. We may not be able to travel. So then what do we do? And if we look within ourselves, if we fall back on our own inner resources, how is that different? And can you think of a time when you sought refuge due to a fear or a dread of a situation? Can you think of a time or an instance where you sought refuge motivated by confidence? Where you sought help motivated by confidence rather than fear? Or even a time where you sought refuge or guidance, motivated by a wish to help others. And so then to just bring this short reflection to a close, make a determination to change direction, to look within our own mind for happiness and contentment, for inner resources, to remember to look within first. Then again, take a nice deep breath and bring your focus back to the room. So again, with the little picture here on the screen, it's like we can't stop the rain of misfortune, but we can protect our mind if we kind of remember to do so, to change direction like that. So then the next thing that I wanted to tackle was, well, how can we tell if what our refuge is valid? How do we know if where we put our faith or our trust or our confidence in a spiritual path, if it's going to turn out well, or if we're just going to be led off in some terrible direction? So how do we know? So the four qualities of a valid refuge, or so will turn out well, is a great checklist, not just for a religious refuge or a spiritual refuge, but I'd say a refuge in whoever's going to teach you to do anything, or whatever political party that you're following, or a philosophical or an art movement, or even, you know, which housing co-op to join. This is a really good checklist. It covers everything. So what makes something valid or reliable, a fitting refuge? So there are four qualities. So one is that they themselves are free from all fears. So if we're going to put our trust in somebody to help us overcome problems, they themselves have to have overcome problems. Otherwise, they're just going to be like our dear friends, aren't they? Who wish they could help us, but are just as stuck as we are. So whoever we trust, it's like whoever we trust to invest our money in, we want to make sure they've got some money, that they just haven't lost all their money. So that's like number one to check out. And if somebody is teaching how to be peaceful or kind, they themselves must be peaceful and kind. Or if they're teaching how to overcome fear of life, fear of dying, they themselves must have overcome those fears and everything that, you know, contributes to them. So that's number one. They've got to have done it themselves. And not only that, but they've got to have a means or a method to be able to free others. So it says here, you know, they have the means to free others from fear. So that's the fear of that kind of existential angst that we have of what's it all about, the meaning of life, the kind of the really big picture. So not only that they themselves are free, but they have a method that we can use that will also help us. That they can communicate in a way that resonates with us. So many self-help books, for instance, have lots of really helpful little things to do, but whoever's written them hasn't necessarily put them into practice or hasn't necessarily realized all of those things. And I remember seeing one show on hoarders, and there was a lady who was a professional organizer. She made her money from being a professional organizer. And in the little documentary, it turned out she was a hoarder herself. So would you put your faith in someone like that? Because, you know, they might have the means to free. They might have this theory, but have they actually put the method into practice and actually got the results? So we really want both. Same if we have a fitness coach We want them to be fit and we want them to be able to share it with us. So those two, then the other two, that they have great compassion for all, whether they're close or not. So how they feel about others, whether they're their relatives or the same ethnic background or whatever, whether it's the same or different, they have equal compassion for everybody. So it's not sorting out these people and those people. It's everybody. So anyone who just works solely for one group of people and leaves out another group of people, your red flag, warning flags come up straight away. That kind of bias or partiality. Thinking, well, those ones don't matter. And then that they aim to help everybody. So how they act regardless of how they're treated. So regardless of whether, you know, the Buddha aims to help everybody, regardless of whether you're Buddhist or not, whether you're a good person or a bad person, whether you're polite or whether you're rude, whether you have money or whether you're poor, doesn't matter. How to the Buddha, from the Buddha's point of view, regardless of how the Buddha is treated, the aim is to help everybody. So those two things as well, it's a great checklist for if you're going off to do a weekend retreat, you just put this checklist and go, oh, is it just for the rich people or is it just for the white people or is it just for the women or just for the men or whatever it is, or is the aim to benefit everybody? Because even something like, say, feminism, if the aim is just to benefit women, we know that's just going to lead to conflict. But actually, feminism is to benefit everybody, isn't it? So it's a very nice checklist to put for everything, including a spiritual journey, an inner journey. So questions, comments? So this is to do with the refuge in the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, which we're going to get to in a moment. But I think it can apply to anything because I look at art movements, for instance, and how they turn out in the world, why some turn out so beneficial and revolutionary and others aren't, or political parties or philosophical worldviews. So that's just my take on it, that you can apply it to a whole lot more as well. You can apply it to worldly things because, and also I'm a great fan of checklists. I like to really know. But definitely for a spiritual path, it should have this checklist. Because if you have a spiritual path that just has compassion for my people, it's like, you know, in the Middle Ages where they say God is on our side. Well, that means, you know, with impunity, you can go and kill everybody else. So that's not a spiritual path. But this kind of points out why. So if we have a fitting refuge and it meets that criteria, there's amazing benefits that come from that. So the benefits, once we find a spiritual path that we can have confidence in, one of the things that happens is we stop being distracted. So most of the time we just battle against distraction, don't we? We try and force ourselves to focus, but things come up and this and that and whatever. But actually, naturally, we stop being distracted if we have real confidence in what we're doing. And we're also driven by a little bit of fear of, hey, our time is limited. Then we don't lose our way. Then our path through life becomes clear. When things happen to us, we can still find our path through what it means, what we can do, how we can use circumstances as they change. And that gnawing thought that I had, you know, all my life of what's it for? Like, what am I going to do with my life? Because I can't cure malaria and I, you know, can't be prime minister. So what am I going to do? So we're able to find our way through life with what's happening in our day-to-day life instead of trying to turn into somebody else. We'll find the purpose in our day-to-day life. We also naturally become a better human being. we're protected from suffering. So we become a better human being and a kinder, safer human being. So that's a, if we have a valid refuge, we end up a better person. We don't end up a worse, grouchier person. If we're ending up a worse, grouchier person, we haven't got a true refuge. Or if we end up more fearful, we haven't got a good, strong refuge. And we're protected from suffering. So that means that even when bad things happen, we don't lose it. We don't lose our equilibrium. We've got what's commonly called resilience. That whatever happens, we also have a confidence that even though we live with uncertainty, we don't know what's going to happen, we're not terrified. We're not eaten up by anxiety. So our mind is protected from suffering, regardless of what's going on. So there are four kind of things that I was looking at, just going, well, we're all striving for these, but it's like we're striving for a result, but what's the cause? It has a common cause. And the litmus test for me, this one, that we know we're on the right track when we stop overly concentrating on the faults of others and start looking within, at which I hang my head in shame. Is it dang? Little bit of a litmus test there, yes. I have a couple of things to read, but I think we might do another little reflection, and then we can get into the Buddhist refuge. So just another reflection, just to bring this into our own experience. Again, nice deep breath, settle the posture, straighten the spine. Relax the shoulders. And gently bring your focus inwards. And this time we're going to look at in who or what do we seek refuge in? So when we're sick, who do we normally seek refuge in? Might be a doctor, it might be a homeopath, but we have someone or something that we seek refuge in when we have a physical illness. When we're hungry, what do we seek refuge in? When we wanted to learn to read or write, who did we seek refuge in then? When we're bored or dissatisfied, what do we seek refuge in at the moment? When we're scared, what do we seek refuge in? Or when we're lonely or lost? So all of our default kind of automatic refuges that we have, do they meet those four criteria? Are they themselves free from fears and problems and confusion? Is it a method that can actually lead me out of the problem? Is whoever or whatever that we seek refuge in unbiased, impartial? Can we have that refuge regardless of our gender, our sexual orientation, our age, our finances? And our expectations, are they realistic? Or do we have to keep searching? So to bring this short reflection to a close, then feel very good about questioning. Make a determination, at the very least, to continue to question with a relaxed, open mind until you can confidently say you've found a valid refuge. Then a nice deep breath again, gently let it out. Okay, so now let's look at the Buddhist refuge. So the Buddhist refuge, there are three jewels or three objects of refuge: the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So my friend Cheryl, because she first came across Buddhism in a book, when she started talking about it, she said Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. I thought it's like a good old Aussie Sangha. But that's what happens when you're a real bookworm. So Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So this is from this great book, How to Meditate, by Kathleen McDonald. Really excellent resource, this book. So her little introduction. In Buddhism, devotion is associated with refuge, the first step on the path to liberation and awakening. Refuge is the attitude of relying upon or turning to something for guidance and help. In an ordinary sense, we take refuge in friends for love and security, in food and entertainment when we're hungry and bored, and so on. But such external sources of refuge can satisfy our needs only temporarily, because they, as well as the happiness that they bring, are impermanent and unreliable. So it's not saying that those things are bad at all, but as a refuge that we put all of our store of our well-being into, impermanent and unreliable. Buddhist refuge, on the other hand, involves discovering and utilizing the unlimited potential that lies within each of us. There are two aspects of refuge, an outer refuge and an inner refuge. Outer refuge is appreciating and relying upon the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And let's see, the inner refuge is refuge in ourselves, in our ultimate potential. The three refuges have their internal counterparts. So let's have a look. The Buddha jewel. Let's move that over here. So the Buddha, the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, who is depicted as the statue behind me, was an actual human being who demonstrated the way. So the ultimate role model, who actually showed you can be a human, actually transform your life and become enlightened, overcome all problems. It's possible. So we need to have a role model. We need to have the proof. Somebody else has done it before us that it is possible to do. So the external Buddha, the outer Buddha, the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, who is a teaching Buddha. There have been many Buddhas, but Shakyamuni Buddha was the one who actually demonstrated for everybody to be able to kind of have the confidence, and then taught for a good 40 or more years all the different methods of how we too can do this. So a Buddha has perfected all of their qualities, wisdom, compassion, and ability. So perfect wisdom means not just having an idea or a theory, but directly knowing reality, having perfected your understanding of life, the universe, and everything. And not just as a general kind of interest thing, but perfect wisdom as to the nature of our mind and why we suffer and what we can do about it. So eliminated all obscurations, delusions, negativities, and their causes. And then developed all of the qualities to the utmost extent, developed all of the wisdom, developed all of the good heart, the compassion, the spontaneously, effortlessly wanting to help others with all of the abilities. So because there is no barrier in a Buddha's mind, it means a Buddha is omniscient, can perfectly know and understand every living being. Kathleen McDonald says, Buddha refers both to the enlightened state itself, the removal of all negative qualities and the perfection of all positive ones, and to those who've attained enlightenment. Refuge in Buddha means opening our heart to the love and wisdom offered by these beings and accepting their guidance on the spiritual path. The inner Buddha, our own potential, the seed within every living being for enlightenment. So it's like the outer Buddha leads us to this inner potential, because it's not that the Buddha can kind of pluck out our suffering, but the outer Buddha, or even just like seeing a Buddha statue, makes people feel nice, peaceful. Why? Because it awakens you to your own potential for that. So actually, one way to view the Buddha statues is to think of them as a mirror. You're looking at a mirror. Every nice feeling that you have when you look at a Buddha statue is because it's mirroring what your potential is. So actually, every time that you bow hello to somebody, it's like you're acknowledging my Buddha nature acknowledges your Buddha nature. If you bow down towards an altar or a statue, it's kind of like you're bowing down to that potential within yourself. So later on in the course, we're going to talk about the nature of our mind and how come we do have this potential, why it's not just some guy or some Asian person or someone in the olden days, but it's a potential every living being has. So then the Dharma jewel. So the Dharma is the actual refuge. So if we're looking at Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, the Buddha, his teachings and the spiritual community, if we're going to have just one, it's not the Buddha. Because the Buddha can't make us happy or sad. What does is the teachings. That's the actual refuge. So even, you know, sometimes in our pujas, our offering ceremonies, and people make dedications and say, oh, you know, please Buddha or please Tara, fix up this or fix up that. It's like, that's not how it happens. The actual refuge is the Dharma, and what the Dharma is changing our mind. So the outer Dharma, all the texts, the teachings, all the sutras, all the Dharma books that we read, the notes that you're taking, that's one form. The sutras, the written down spoken words of the Buddha. But it's a lot more than what's written down, because what's written down is the wisdom, and wisdom is a living experience. It's not in the book, it's in the mind of someone who's reading the book. So the wisdom in the mind of an Arya. An Arya is someone who's directly can directly see reality with no confusion or distortion. So the wisdom is a living experience. So she says, Dharma refers to wisdom, the realizations that comprise the progressive stages on the path to enlightenment. The literal meaning of the Sanskrit term Dharma is to hold. It includes any method that holds us or protects us from problems. So it's got these two things, to hold us back from suffering, to hold us back from problems. The other thing is to hold to. something that can hold true to guide us, that we can grasp at, that will help us. The Buddha's teachings are known as the Dharma because they come from his actual experience of eliminating every trace of confusion and negative energy from his mind. Refuge in Dharma means practicing the prescribed methods, aspiring to awaken within ourselves the wisdom that every enlightened being has discovered. So we have the outer Dharma, and actually over here on the corner of the altar here, you see all those little pigeonholes? That's all the Tibetan texts. So it's the teachings of the Buddha and the commentaries, the Kangyur and the Tengyur, written in Tibetan. So, I mean, for us, that doesn't really mean anything, does it? Well, I can't read it. But it's there symbolically to represent the whole body of wisdom of the Buddha Dharma. But that's not the refuge. If I go and bow to that, that's not going to help me, is it? It's actually applying it. It's got to come into our mind. So the inner Dharma is our own wisdom, our own realizations, and the ability for us to distinguish right from wrong. So the inner Dharma is to know, what do we do here? Like when something changes in life and you're scratching your head, what do I do? What do I do? How do I act? How can I help? Often we can just be caught up not knowing, not being able to tell what's our direction here. So the inner Dharma helps us know right from wrong, what we should do. And so the inner Dharma is our practice, and the main practice, like we saw, refraining from harm, ceasing harm. And if we can do that, then we have that inner protection. No external or internal problems can harm us. So even if we're in very difficult circumstances, everybody around us is really aggressive, our mind won't be disturbed. We'll have something to fall back on that will hold us back from being disturbed. And even if we ourselves have a physical sickness, or even if we have anxiety or depression, that won't disturb us either. It might be an experience that we go through, but we won't be disturbed. We'll have that inner refuge. So the inner Dharma is our natural wisdom that can distinguish real from false. So it's that kind of natural wisdom that comes, that clears away the confusion. Questions, comments yet on the Buddha or the Dharma? Yes. The sutras are the written down words or discourses of the Buddha, or discourses that happened in the presence of the Buddha. So they weren't written down immediately because it was an oral tradition to start with, but a couple of hundred years later. So there are many sutras. Not all of them have been translated into English, but there are several main ones that we rely on in this tradition. So actually tomorrow is a big holy day, so we're reading two sutras tomorrow. One in the morning, Sangata Sutra, and then one in the evening, the Diamond Cutter Sutra, which is the one on developing wisdom, otherwise known as the Vajra Smasher, because it smashes your delusion. So it's quite short. And a lot of the sutras, when you read them, it's like reading some, some esoteric physics manual or something. You're just like, I don't understand one single word in here. On one hand, because they're so dense with teachings, and on the other hand, they've got this lilting kind of poetic way because it's an oral tradition, so it's like a story that comes out, and they really affect your mind. So from starting to read them, especially the Diamond Cutter, where I didn't understand one single word, but I still just felt so happy at the end every single time we read it, is it makes it these imprints on your mind. Okie dokie. So then the sangha jewel, the helpers, the spiritual community. So the outer sangha, actually when we talk about the sangha, what we really mean are the Arya beings who have realized the ultimate nature of reality. So they have a direct experience of reality. So without any distortions or biases or emotional baggage, without without the intermediary of having a philosophy or an idea, just directly knowing reality, meaning directly knowing the nature of our mind, the nature of cause and effect, the nature of the world, the nature of our emotions. So that kind of the beings that have that realization in their minds are the Sangha, the outer Sangha. But also on a more kind of colloquial level, it means all of the qualified guides. So the lamas, the monks and nuns, the geshis that have the study and the experience to guide us are the Sangha. Renunciates, monks or nuns across the world, they're renunciates. What is it in Christianity? Poverty, chastity, and obedience. in Buddhism, it's very similar. Killing, stealing, lying, sexual misconduct, or intoxicants as the minimum, and then wearing the robes. So living as a renunciate. But also the Sangha are us, our spiritual community, our peers. How important it is to be able to walk into a room, and even though we don't necessarily know each other, to know that we're on the same page. Isn't it a relief just to know, oh, I'm not a weirdo to have these questions? Somebody else has these questions. Just that, just to know that there are others like us is huge. We need that, because otherwise we feel wrongly very alone or alienated if we don't have that Sangha, that community. And if our community, like, you know, when I was giving up drinking and smoking, and I noticed the majority of people that I knew smoked like chimneys, drank like pirates. So then when I no longer did, then I lost all my friends. Or if I wanted to be their friends, then what happened? I just ended up drinking and smoking again. So what our community is has a huge effect on us. So we have to have a spiritual community to help us. So the Sangha refers to the spiritual community, those who have the wisdom and give us inspiration and support. Buddha and Dharma provide us with the basis of our practice, but Sangha provide the help that we need to make the practice actually work. Talking with like-minded friends, for example, can give us answers to questions and solutions to problems. Meditating together gives us strength and encouragement. A community of meditators offers a peaceful haven from the craziness of city life. Refuge in Sangha means respecting such friends and accepting their help. And we know how hard it is to ask for help, don't we? So it also means taking refuge, means accepting the helps of the help of the spiritual community and having the confidence to ask for help. The inner Sangha, it's our own, the company that we keep in our own mind, our attitudes, our positive attitudes, not our negative attitudes. So a lot of that inner Sangha, in a way, can be like our inner self-talk, which isn't necessarily kind, is it? That's our inner kind of environment. So our inner Sangha are the positive attitudes, the really helpful attitudes, often those attitudes of resilience and patience, tolerance, kindness, compassion, all of those things. That's our inner Sangha. And then the inner Sangha is the guidance and inspiration that we can give others. As human beings, we have the potential to develop unlimited love, compassion, and wisdom, and to free ourselves from all negative energy. In other words, we all have the potential to reach the same level as a Buddha. So Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are the three main jewels of refuge, or rare sublime ones. So from a Buddhist point of view, these three work together to help and guide us on a spiritual path. And it is rare, and it can lead us all the way to liberation and enlightenment. So then we can have a look at, well, what is our goal? And, you know, why are we here? Why are we seeking a spiritual path or an inner path. And from a Buddhist point of view, the very, very least that our goal should be at least no more suffering in this life, right? That's that. That's our baseline, isn't it? We don't want our life to get worse. So that's the minimum goal that we have. It's not the, it's not as far as we can go, but that's what, that's the baseline we should set. And again, often in puja, people will dedicate, oh, you know, I hope so-and-so recovers from an illness. I hope they don't suffer too much. And I'm like, at least when you do a dedication, dedicate, I hope they are completely free of suffering. We don't want to dedicate, oh, I just want them to suffer a little bit. No. So our goal for this life, of course, we don't want any more suffering in this life. And that may be one of our main reasons for seeking a spiritual path. But actually, we're not on a spiritual path if we're just thinking of this life. It's still a worldly path. And this blew my mind when I first heard about it. It really caught me up short, because I've been really interested in all of the Buddhist philosophy and techniques, especially to deal with emotions, because I just wanted to solve this week's problem. So that's not a spiritual path. I'm like, what? You're kidding me. We're only on a spiritual path when we start thinking, what happens next? What happens after I die? Then it becomes a spiritual journey. So then, once we start thinking there's this life, but then what? Then we're on a spiritual path. So again, the very least that we want is in the future, no worse than what we have now. We don't want to go down. We want to have at least as good as we have now or better. So, you know, if we're a human being now, a little picture of a baby there, we don't want to get reborn as an animal next time. It's going to be quite horrendous if that happens. So once we start thinking what happens after this life, then we're on a spiritual journey. And there are, of course, there are things that we can do for this life to make sure that things turn out fairly well by working on our own mind. Then we can think about, well, what we do now is going to have reverberations and consequences into the future as well. So we can make sure that at least in the future, we're not going to end up in somewhere worse, more terrifying, more stressful. But is that it? Are we just going to keep going around and around and around? So actually, the next goal can be individual liberation, liberation from the whole cycle of existence, instead of going up and then going down and then going up and going down, which, as we know, we're already sick of it in our own life now, let alone from life to life to life. So individual liberation, or nirvana. We can aspire to achieve a state where we have the complete cessation of suffering, so that we attain a state of lasting peace. I mean, isn't that what we're yearning for? A state where we feel completely content, completely safe, all that uncertainty, all the delusion, confusion gone. And that state is possible because if we remove ignorance and all the afflictive emotions that cause our unhappiness, if we remove all the causes, it's going to be impossible to be unhappy. So if we achieve nirvana, or individual liberation, that's a state where you can't fall back down again. It's like if you learn to read, you can't just, you won't wake up tomorrow and not be able to read. You can't fall back from realizations like that. So individual liberation, or nirvana, is a state of lasting peace. There's no going backwards. You are completely free from suffering and all of its causes. But there's more. So from, this is a Mahayana Buddhist center, from a Mahayana point of view, just my own liberation is not enough, because what about you? How can I be happy when there's still all these others suffering? So there's an even bigger goal that we can have, which is full enlightenment, that I would like to be able to help everybody else into a state of peace and happiness, freedom. How can little old me do that? Well, in my current state, it's impossible. But if I became a Buddha, if I became fully enlightened, then I could. So a Buddha is not just, you know, from the Buddha's point of view, a Buddha has liberation, freedom, from their own side, completely free. But Buddhahood is a lot more. It's having developed all of the qualities to their utmost extent to be able to help others. So full enlightenment is having developed all of your compassion, wisdom, and all the skills and abilities to be able to perfectly, spontaneously, effortlessly help sentient beings. So that's the whole purpose why you become a Buddha, is for the work for others, to help others. So it's called the universal goal because it includes every single living being without exception. Because how could you leave anybody out? So if you're looking at this, you might think, you might go through stages in your life where this changes, where it's a kind of over a space of several years where it develops in this trajectory. You may feel comfortable with just one. Often if you sit down to meditate, I start where I am. I start with, I just don't want today's problem. But then I go, oh, hang on a second, there's more. And then I build it up until trying to get to this altruistic approach for full enlightenment. So just in one meditation session, you can go through this. What I think is really important is that you think about it and don't put a limit on what your aim or your motivation is. Don't think, oh, well, it's nice for other people to aim to become a Buddha, but I could never. It's kind of like saying, oh, you know, I only want to become this wise, but that's it, that'll do me. Or anybody want to become this happy, but that'll do. Or only want to be happy like 3 days a week and the rest of the time I'll cope. Go for the big one. If we go for the big one, of course we're going to get all the rest in between. So why I put this at the end is because we're not going to go for the big one of full enlightenment for the benefit of all if we don't have confidence that it's possible. So that's why we've got to really look at the refuge and what those refuges are and is it possible to do. Otherwise, you can look at this and just get really depressed. So when I was a little kiddie and I heard about this attitude of full enlightenment for the benefit of all, I just found that so overwhelming. You know, I'm like, what can I do? I'm just six. It's a bit much. I've got the whole weight of the world on my shoulders, you know. And so what was missing was the confidence that it's possible. There was just the weight of it, the fear, the dread, but not the confidence or the understanding how it's possible. So we really need both. Okay, so summary. We've got to make sure that we have a valid refuge that will bring the result that we want. So if we want lasting happiness, we've got to make sure that our refuge is something that can bring us lasting happiness. We've got the three jewels in the Buddhist tradition that give us guidance, what to do, the way forward, and protection from losing our mind, from becoming disturbed. And there's the outer refuge that leads us to the inner refuge, the experience, reveals our inner potential. And I'd say have the courage for the big goals in life. And remember, the biggest goal is including the benefit of everybody, including the happiness of everyone, and having a responsibility, like a big-hearted responsibility, like you're saying about, you know, the family gives you the meaning. So what if everybody was our family? Then the meaning's huge. The big-heartedness is huge. There's a huge amount of energy that comes with that. So before we finish, questions, comments? Have I put the case well? So Kathleen McDonald says, usually we find it difficult to feel good about ourselves and to have confidence in our own potential. Instead, we take refuge in the outside things. Just imagine the boredom, the uneasiness, and the games the mind would play if we were completely alone for a day or even an hour, cut off from people, books, television, and all external means of occupying ourselves. Well, we know what happened when that happened, don't we? Just the thought of it makes people so unhappy. We can't conceive of living without sense objects, the external world. However, it is possible to be completely satisfied and happy, whatever the situation, by relying solely on our inner resources. The external refuge objects exist to awaken us to these resources, to our inner Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. When we recognize and nourish this potential, we'll have found the real meaning of refuge. Yes. Well, there is a fear factor of being reborn. And in a way, if we haven't kind of addressed the question of mind and the nature of the continuity of the mind, it might feel like we're being emotionally manipulated, which is what a lot of, you know, political parties would say, you know, like religion is poison, you know, it's just a way of subduing the masses. And in a way, it can be subverted that way. But we do need a fear factor, because it's kind of like, you know, when your parents told you to go to school, and like the whole thing of, well, you need to go to school to learn to read, to have a career, to be able to live in a house and have a job and a life, that didn't cut it. But the thing of like, I will get a talking to if I don't go to school, the short-term one, that really cut it. So at the time, there is a bit of emotional manipulation in a way, but it's for a purpose. And so as our purpose grows, then it becomes different. So once we have a purpose to become a Buddha, then the idea of future lives becomes beneficial, because it's great. Now I can come back and keep helping, instead of, oh my God, now I'm going to come back and I'm just going to go up and down and around all over again. So it changes our purpose then. So, I mean, a lot of questions come up from that, doesn't it? Of like, what happens next? Is there a next? What do we base our belief on? Is it a belief? Where's the evidence? All of these things, like just millions of these questions come up from that one thing. So sentient beings suffer, including us, this life, future lives, you know, what's coming next. Where is the urgency in that? It's like being hungry, you know. Where's the urgency in that? It's right there. If it's not for us, it's for others. Yes, so helping someone is not nice to you. It's like you've got to take a really big step back and go, why are they not nice? And the only possible reason is they're suffering. They're confused, or they're laboring under prejudices, and all of that comes from suffering, fear. So from my point of view, I can feel for them without liking them. So you don't have to like them. But actually liking someone, that's quite superficial. It's just to do with personality. Like if you're loud or if you're quiet. Or if you can speak the same language. Or even just if you've been in the vicinity of somebody. So it doesn't actually, being able to help somebody doesn't, it's not based on whether we like them or not, but we do have to go deeper. So we have this idea like people being professional. So a doctor, for instance, or a teacher, we expect them to help the ones they don't like. So how do they dig deep and do that? Because they look below the initial feeling. And you might have to use some reasoning, go, oh, okay, the reason this person is so destructive and so mean comes from this whole series of circumstances, and at base it's confusion and suffering. And as many of you, you know, been to my previous courses, that my go-to thing that I remember about this is just thinking about any brutalized guard dog, you know, that they're dangerous, they're destructive. That dog wasn't even brutalized, that just killed that baby the other day. I mean, how horrendous is that? So that's not because the dog is evil. It's just the circumstances and the breed and the new being in the house, and all of these things come together. And you can feel for the dog, you can feel for the baby, you can feel for the parents. It doesn't mean you're going to go and hug the dog, but you can still really care. So that's my go-to example, the brutalized dogs. And also that, if you've ever watched Cesar Millan, the dog whisperer, brutalized dogs can be rehabilitated. And so can human beings. Maybe not immediately, and from a Buddhist point of view, maybe not in this life, but it's possible. Yep. So good question. We have to come at it in all different approaches. Yes, there is another book, a go-to book that I'll probably be quoting from a lot in this course, and it's actually called The Foundation of Buddhist Practice by His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Thupten Chodron. So it's a relatively new book. There's a whole series. And so this is the one with the beautiful cover and the purple edge. There's about five in the series, different colours on the edge. This one, The Foundation of Buddhist Practice. So to go with the foundation, beginner's foundation course, really accessible and really authentic Dharma. Just a beautiful tone to them. Because, you know, Thupten Chodron, she's a Western nun. And so the two of them together, how they're presented, you can't go wrong. So those two, for starters, that's pretty much take to a desert island. Okay, so let's do a little dedication and then I'll tell you what's going on next week and we can finish. So again, just take a moment to take a nice deep breath. And let everything settle, everything that we've talked about, the new concepts, the questions, the aha moments, the confusion, everything. Let it settle into your mind. And feel that all of the Buddha's wisdom, the Buddha's teachings, and everything that we've heard about tonight is like a rainfall of light. Gently falling into your mind, illuminating your mind. And feel it absorbing into you countless drops of light. And dedicate that we'll be able to come back to these questions, these topics again and again to develop our good heart and our realizations. And that even the goals that we've discussed all the way up to full enlightenment for the benefit of all, merely by hearing about it, may it become possible. May we bring it to fruition. And so that way we can dedicate all of our efforts for all living beings, for the protection of the planet, for the protection of the vulnerable, for the development of wisdom and the good heart in our minds and the minds of others, and for us to be that positive force in the world, being able to share that with everybody, and at the very least, that we won't harm, that we will be a safe person to be around. And that way contribute to world peace right now, starting with ourselves. Okay, so next week. Next week, oh, well, during the week, have a look. Just have a look at what your refuge is. What's your default refuge? And what's your inspiration? Keep asking those questions. Next week, we're going to have a look at a topic called We Are All Sick, how to become your own therapist and applying the teachings in daily life like a medicine. Okay, thank you so much for coming along and sitting here with your masks on. I really appreciate it. That's great. Online people, just give me 1 minute and I'll be there.